October 21st, 2008 session of the House Interim Workforce and Economic Development Committee will be in order. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate the committee members turning out for our hearing today. Thank you, audience members, as well as the list of witnesses that we'll be having today. We're going to be talking a good deal about workforce development today. It is, of course, a fundamental component of economic development. Last session and the session, the 2007 and 8 sessions, we heard a great deal in this committee. I think about a combined total of close to 4 weeks, Vice Chair Riley, of informational hearings that dealt in one way or another with workforce development. And I dare say that coming out of those hearings, there's probably no other committee in the United States that probably had a better handle on some of the challenges that both our employer community as well as our workforce community face in terms of being able to prepare the workforce for employer needs over the next decade. We did a tremendous job of identifying challenges. It is the intent of the chair and with discussions with the two vice chairs that our committee move forward in the 2009 session with some solutions to these problems and so that we can maintain the faith with the Oregon benchmarks that have been established that our state will have a workforce which is second to none, not only in our nation, but in the Pacific Rim as well as globally. With that, first we're going to have an update on enterprise zones. And I would like to ask, please, if Paul Warner would come forward and give us that briefing. And Mazin, you're going to you're co-pilot today. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office, and with me is Mazin Malik, also from Legislative Revenue Office. I've been spending a lot of my time still trying to reform the tax system, so I've asked Mazin to kind of brief you on some of the details of the project. He's been working a lot more closely with a project than I have in the last month or so. I just wanted to give you a couple of comments about how we're progressing. First of all, we did make a decision several months ago this summer because we did have a little bit of extra dollars in our budget to hire Ed Waters to help us work on the project. Ed is a former Legislative Revenue Office economist, a lot of experience in regional economic modeling. In fact, he was really the main designer of our Oregon tax incidence model. So we're very lucky that Ed was available, and he's working on a contractual basis with us on this project. In fact, Ed has put together kind of the update outline that you'll have in front of you. Just a couple of things about how we're proceeding. The initial look at enterprise zones is to look at the internal rates of return in which sponsoring governments could anticipate. We're particularly interested in the time period it would take for a sponsoring government to recoup the losses in terms of exempt property. In other words, what kind of a period of time would you have to expect a property to remain on the tax rolls in order to recoup the loss from the exemption? And this kind of gives the most narrow perspective you could have on that decision. It looks at it as an individual company would look at, I'm giving up tax revenue, how long does it take me to recoup that if this exempt property stays on the tax base on a permanent basis? The other approach we're looking at to start to broaden it out is to look at the focus on the employment effects and the payroll effects in those particular zones. And for that, we're using a relatively short time period, 2003 to 2006, primarily because we have good information from the Employment Department for that time period. We have very detailed information, and we have a sample in which we'll be drawing for that, and Mazin will go through that with you. The third approach to get at the last piece, really, in Senate Bill 151 is to take a longer-term look at the broader effects of enterprise zones. How might they affect the community in terms of poverty rates or per capita income? In order to do that, you really have to back off and use 2 points in terms of census data. So we're going to look at a 1990 to 2000 period in which enterprise zones have been operational and compare those with a control group in which they haven't, which they're not in existence. So to see what kind of distinction we can make between those two, the zone areas and the non-zone areas. Our goal really is to provide you with a better understanding. I don't think we're going to come out of this realistically with a conclusion that enterprise zones are good or bad, but I think we're going to have some good information for you in order to make decisions in the future about trying to recognize the costs and benefits, what kind of evidence do we have that areas that are using zones are doing better than other areas, for example, what kinds of characteristics do the zones have that have been relatively successful. So I think we'll have some good objective information for you going forward to make decisions. We also hope that by setting up a framework that could be applied to other types of incentives, we'll help to develop a prototype for you to use. We get a lot of questions, of course, in Revenue Committee. I know you do here as well about what kinds of incentives are effective. And if we can set up a framework to start looking at the various approaches, it might help us and make those decisions and give you better information about the results of these incentives. So I'll close there, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say a special thanks to the agencies that have been working very closely with us. Employment Department has been very helpful in gathering employment data in the zones. They have a large database and have been working with us very closely. Economic Development's worked with us very closely. Art Fish is in the back of the room here, and he's been very cooperative in helping identify the exempt property in those zones. And we've also been working very closely with the Revenue Department and the assessed value and market value for property in the zones. So that's been very helpful to us, and we also, the other part of our review team is the county, cities, and special districts who have been giving us some guidance as we make the decisions on methodology and so forth. So I'll turn it over to Mazin to give you a little bit more detail on how the project's going.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mazin Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. It's good to see all of you, and as it's turning cold.
Good to have you, Mazin. Welcome.
Thank you, sir. You know, since I'm starting or getting close to turning 40, I have to take my glasses off. But in front of you, we have two handouts. One of them would be the progress report that describes in general terms of how the study, how the research has been going. And a second one that I will talk about later, it basically shows the basic building blocks of what we are looking at. The main thing with the project that we have established first and foremost an advisory group of a number of people who are with expertise and knowledge about these issues to have a number of sets of eyes, if you will, that will guide us in what we do, how we do it, and does it make sense, are we in the right direction or not. So as Paul talked, we took three main routes towards this study. The first one, we've agreed with the study group on, first of all, taking a sample of E-zones or enterprise zones and stratify the sample into five main categories. Those are the ones that you have in the table in front of you. These are as urban metro, we took two enterprise zones, urban west, Willamette Valley, sorry, that's Salem Springfield, and then rural west side, east side, and remote. Those have different times of inception dates. These zones we would be looking at primarily look at those zones, what are the statistics and the census data say about them. Now, what the employment department is pulling is all the employment numbers, all the different characteristics of the that economics in that area. And the important thing is how we are going to compare them to comparable areas somewhere else that does not or do not still yet or don't have ever had an enterprise zone. And through that comparison, come to a conclusion whether the enterprise zone have actually contributed to the increase in economic development as we see it and or not. And the basic building blocks for looking at those, that has always been an issue of how do we look at it, is the what we call the census tract. And in the other page that I've given you, census tract is the way the Bureau of Census looks at the different segments of where the population centers are. And in the in this, we have in front of you the different census tracts. For example, and this is only an example, just to bring it to kind of a flavor for your consideration. This is the Columbia County different census tracts. And you would see in the map those two of those census tracts. This is how they develop. And those census tracts are unique. The sum of them will make a county. However, if you put some of them together in a certain way, you could somehow approximate where that enterprise zone is and therefore come up with the characteristics of those enterprise zones and be able to compare them with the characteristics of the non-enterprise zones. That work is currently being done. The Employment Department is pulling all that data. There's a significant amount of data that is being pulled, and we really, as Paul mentioned, appreciate the work that they've been doing for us. The second stage that we would go is with the longer term, going from 1990 to 2000, taking the same kind of approach, but instead of looking at it in comparable geographic terms, we're looking at it in a comparable temporal times. So it's what's the time difference between the 1990 and 2000? What happened because of that enterprise zone in action? And how did it make a difference, basically? And that will take a little more work. The enterprise zones that will be involved with that study might or might not be the same ones that we're looking at here. At the time of the period we're looking at, there were 35 enterprise zones. We don't necessarily probably have the ability to look at all of them at this time, because that will entail a lot of work and detail. But we will take a sample, probably somewhere between 25 to 50% of those, and be able to make some conclusions on that. And finally, the third one would be how to look at the specific firms, which ones took which credits and tax abatements, and see how those have been able to increase and give some level of return for the localities and the local government at that time, and how that payback, if you will, or that exchange between credits and jobs and income and so on have occurred. Those are coming through time. It has been an interesting process, and we really enjoy it, and we thank you for all the opportunities that you've given us to study this.
And I am sure that there are adequate opportunities to study as well. Could either of you just very briefly revisit why it is that you're conducting this study? And of course it's because the legislature requested, but the reasons behind that might be helpful for some.
Okay. Mr. Chair, you know, I can certainly talk about that in terms of the discussions that the Revenue Committee's had in the last session. The Enterprise Zone program, which is one of our major programs in terms of size of property tax exemption, was up for sunset. There was a consensus, I think, to go ahead and continue the program, but there was a real desire, I think, certainly part of the committees that I talked with, was to have a better sense of how effective they were, what were the costs and benefits associated with this program, can we get a better way to measure quantitatively what the impact has been. And so that is the reason I know that the amendment was put in that required the study. The idea, I think, also was to have someone from the outside come in that is not directly involved in the policy implementation, which is a role which I think is why it ended up in our lap. And one of the things I've found, and we've been in this situation in a number of areas, as to provide an objective analysis, well, you still have to work very closely with those that are implementing the policy in order to know what's going on and have the appropriate data. So, again, that's why working with the agencies has been very important for us and helped us, I think, frame this up to the point where we'll be able to get some good results. But I think that clearly the desire was to have a better sense of how effective these types of programs are and to find a way to develop some performance measures on what we're, you know, what the state or what local governments are investing in terms of lost property tax dollars.
Great, thank you. Questions or comments from the committee? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, this is a fascinating project, and I'm just kind of curious how you select the specific enterprise zones that you're studying. And the only reason I bring that up is because in my community there's been a little bit of controversy around the West Eugene enterprise zone with the closure of Hynix and the loss of several hundred jobs, and of course the first thing that happened was people were questioning whether all the tax abatements were really worth what we got, and I don't know that anybody's really been able to answer that. Of course, I've seen the pros and cons from both sides, I think that one would make an interesting addition to your study, although the figures are probably pretty much more current than you're able to really examine at this point. But anyway, my question is, you know, how do you go through and pick the enterprise zones so you're not just picking ones that have been successes and not, you know, ignoring the ones that maybe have failed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the key factors that came in, first of all, was this regional breakdown. We wanted to have something that fit into those categories because we thought those were clearly distinguishable environments, and that we wanted to get a sense of whether the policies could be more effective one area versus another. The other limitation is the dates and the data that we can match up with the census in terms of fitting with the census tracts. So that was a key element, too, in our decision. But the issue that you raise about kind of picking successes versus where it hasn't been effective, that came up very clearly in our discussions with our review team. It was brought up by Tony Ruffalo, who's on our review team from Portland State. Because initially we had gone through and looked at those and said, well, Art Fish had told us here's a couple of zones that have had no activity. And so initially, well, you know, what's the point of including those? But Tony made the point that those are some, you shouldn't have a selectivity bias of just picking those where you've had activity. You should include all of them so that you've got a realistic sense of the possibility of outcome. So we have made that decision to include several enterprise zones in the 1990 to 2000 period that have had no activity, just so we can use those characteristics and include them in the results. So we are consciously making sure we don't pick just winners and that we pick a broad sampling of the zones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions or comments? I'm Representative Holvey's question triggered a question in my mind here. Would Would clawbacks be a common provision in most of the enterprise zone agreements?
Yes, I believe they are.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm also wondering, too, I would suspect that enterprise zones are not unique to Oregon, that there are other states that have either the same or similar kinds of entities with similar goals.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you're familiar with any studies that have been done in other states and what the findings are there in terms of the efficacy and the return on the dollars that in essence are foregone in lieu of economic development and future prosperity. So,
Mr. Chair, yes, the answer is that enterprise zones have been very widely used among the states, and so we do have a lot of examples out there. We don't have a lot of good examples of detailed studies, and you know, and when you look at any policy decisions like this and how they might affect the economic environment, it's very difficult to show causality. I mean, you can show correlation, and those types of studies have been done. And probably the best that we've spent the most time looking at, that seems to be the most comprehensive, is California, in which they have done a pretty extensive analysis of their enterprise zone program there and gone through in detail under what circumstances they appear to be more effective than others.
All right. And finally, what is the timeline in terms of having the study results available?
Mr. Chair, the Senate Bill 151 requires us to file a report on or before February 1. So that, of course, is our drop-dead deadline. So our intent would be to have something for you in at least in draft form by the end of the calendar year, and then have a final report for you in the first couple of weeks of the session.
Very good. That's very helpful. Anything further, members? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your time, and we will look forward to the product of your efforts here in a couple of months.
All right.
Thank you. All right, next, today we're going to hear from Cam Preuss and Lori Warner on skills development. Welcome, both of you. Glad that you could make it today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lori Warner, Director of the Employment Department.
For the record, Cam Preuss, the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development.
So we thank you for this opportunity to talk about the integration effort between our two agencies. You should have a handout, and these are the slides we're going to speak to here this morning, or this afternoon. The workforce system, let me see, I'm going to run this machine too here. I'll start with just an overview of the Oregon labor force. This is just reminding you the size of the labor force, 1.9 million in Oregon. In September here, we're sitting at 1.8 employed and 115,000 unemployed for an unemployment rate of 6.4%. That's up from a year ago when it was 5.3%, up by about 20,000 individuals additional that are unemployed. The workforce system.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Tilby.
Just clarification, if you please, on the unemployment number. That the unemployed number that you have there is reflects the number of people that are on unemployment insurance.
Correct.
Not necessarily people that don't have jobs.
Correct. This is these are the folks that are drawing unemployment.
Thank you.
The workforce system serves these people, and in Oregon, we, on an average, have about 250,000 Oregonians that access our services over the course of a year. The next slide here is reflecting the fact just that when folks have additional education, you can see this is year-long data, 2007, showing that as educational levels go up, if you follow the unemployment rate, it goes down as educational level goes up. And I think this committee spent quite a bit of time on that last year, last session, speaking to that particular issue. So that's just that sort of big picture context piece.
We're going to be like a tennis match, back and forth, so you don't fall asleep. Again, a context piece is the effort of both of our departments is directed by a strategic plan that comes from the Governor's Workforce Investment Board. That strategic plan was presented to you in as one of your, I would call it a fact-finding sessions during last session, and this is just a reminder that it has three overarching goals, and the first is to ensure that all Oregon employers have the skilled workforce they need for a competitive advantage in the market. Second is that we have prepared an agile and innovative workforce that has the skills for them to be successful in the labor market. And goal number three, which is about which what we are going to speak today, is that we have a flexible and unified education and workforce system that provides the training that consistently meets the needs of both workers and employers. Again, just to take you back to work that you did last session, this is near and dear, as Chair Witt said, certainly near and dear to my heart, having been part of the support to help the committee write the report. And then you'll remember, I think it was in October or November of last year, you had a session where you went through and prioritized. And I actually went back to that work to see what you had prioritized as of major importance to you were how were we then weaving that into our work, because the work of the agencies and around workforce development is guided by the governor through the certainly through the workforce board and that strategic plan, but it's also engagement with the legislature and finding out what your priorities are so that we can blend them together for a better result. And three of the priorities that you listed were around skills gap and meeting just overall skill gap, and then some very specific workforce shortages, and also to have a flexible and unified workforce system. You also had some things around sustainability, climate change, and some other things which are not as relevant to this, at least to our work today. Well, I did want to remind you about the setting that we come to you today under.
Following the session in October of 2007, the Employment Department and Community Colleges and Workforce Development, we hosted a forum that was focused on discussion around the current workforce system, realizing that out of last session there were a lot of issues raised, but we didn't have a lot of solutions necessarily to those. So we talked about the current workforce system, and the folks that were involved with that were staff from both my agency and CAM's agency, along with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board staff, Oregon Economic Development Department, the local workforce investment boards, and the governor's office were all in attendance at that forum. There were about 70 folks involved, and it was facilitated by Greg Newton, who is a consultant who works with many states across the U.S. and has over 20 years of experience in the workforce system, going back to the beginning, I believe, because he can talk from, you know, the initial onslaught of workforce programs up until today. And so we hosted that forum not knowing what the outcome might be at the end of the day in terms of what folks may think we should do with the current base systems that we have that are serving all Oregonians. So next slide. The forum conclusions were, not to anyone's surprise, I think, but that change needed to begin now. there was global competition that were driving business needs, demographics that I think you folks reviewed and everyone's pretty aware of, where we have 2-to-1 in terms of replacement versus growth openings coming over the next 10 years. And the systems have flat or declining federal funding for our current base workforce programs. And then the question was, okay, if change needs to begin now, to what? To what are we trying to move towards? And the group conclusion from the forum was that integration of job seeker and training services needed to happen, that we needed to focus on skill assessment and development, and that we needed a common data system that would link the training pieces to the job placement services that between the two agencies that are operated. There existed 7 data systems on the training side that didn't speak to each other necessarily, and the Employment Department has iMatch Skills, which is the job placement system, and staff could not see between the systems what was being done for clients. So those were the conclusions from the forum, and the momentum to move forward together in addressing these issues and figuring out a plan for how to make this happen in a 1-year time frame, essentially.
You did hear that, in 1-year time frame. I think the way in which Lori and I have thought about this at the forum, when we had over 2 days, a lot of energy, a lot of people recognizing that we couldn't continue to do what we were doing and expect to get a better product. And we really wanted a better product because, for lots of reasons, we were questioning the relevancy of the current workforce system. Is it relevant for employers? Was it relevant for workers? Did they really know what they could get when they came to us? And we've had a core of individuals, both businesses and job seekers, who have used the public workforce system for decades. They know us. They trust us. We need a larger market share. We need to be more relevant to more employers so that more of Oregonians can get those jobs through a connected service. So what we said was, well, what are we going to integrate? Some structures at the local level, some structures at the state level. And we came to the conclusion, and that primarily is because the local workforce boards and local staff at Employment Department said, yes, we can do this. We want to do this. It's necessary to do this. So we have about 500 staff across the state that are being integrated. We have always had really good, in the last decade, we have had very good collaboration. And we've even had co-location, but we haven't necessarily had integration, where it didn't really matter who was serving which individual as they came through the door. Oh, that's yours. Oh, that's mine. No, they're all Oregonians. They're all our customers. So we're looking at a integrated service. As Lori said, we didn't have a common registration. Even though both of our programs are funded under the U.S. Department of Labor, they are funded very separately, and they each have their own performance metrics. Now, you would think that that would not be the case, but it is, and we have tried to manage both at the state and local level to make some seamlessness of that. So we wanted to take it a step further, and so we have built over the last 9 months a common registration system between our two systems, as well as later we will share with you what our performance metrics are. But we essentially said, yes, we must report to the Federal Department of Labor, who is our major funder, that we have met certain performance expectations. But that doesn't mean that we can't have measures that are at least as meaningful to us about preparing workers with the skills they need and making sure that employers are then getting the best job candidate possible. We are doing this within our existing resources. As Lori said, we are flat funded or declining. Federally funded program that is administered through the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department has declined over 20% in the last 2 years. So we have considerably less money than we used to have. But it is important to us to, if you will, reconfigure how the money is spent so that we are doing more skill building for more individuals, because that's really the key to the realm. If you want a better job, is more skills. How have we done it? We've done a lot of work at the state level to realign our policies, and we have used what we term a leadership team, which has both local workforce investment board representatives as well as state staff working to iron out how to get what are both real and perceived barriers out of the way so that integrated service can happen. We've done some very planful things, and we've done some just-in-time things. As we have gone through this process, we have seen things in front of us that we stumble over that we hadn't seen before. For a time, we had a committee that was called the Subtraction Committee. You can't do more with less. You just really can't. And we have less and less money. So we had a committee that talked seriously about what were we not going to do anymore and yet still get a better result for Oregonians. So we've been streamlining policies. We went through a process of asking the local workforce boards to help lead a planning process at the local level that then came to the state. It was reviewed. All the plans subsequently have been approved. We do have a statewide procedure manual that lays out certain standardized procedures but then allows for local augmentation and implementation. And we are using best practices from other states. As Lori said, we are using a consultant who has managed to pull this off in a handful of other states. He's fond of telling us that we are the only state that has done this kind of integration that has taken two separate state agencies and tried to integrate them. Most of the work he has done is in states where these two programs exist inside the same department, but because of the way they are funded and because of their metrics, they have always been managed very separately in a very siloed way. So we, can you tell we're a little proud of the effort so far and of the work that has happened across the state at all levels. Otherwise, it would not be at the place it is.
What integration looks like, there are teams now looking at both job opportunity and skill development needs for each individual as a joint process. There's a welcome team that greets folks as they come into the center, and if some of you have been to the centers before, you may be familiar with the fact that there was a large resource room and folks could come in and kind of self-serve and they could ask questions and such. This is a different model. This is the person coming in, has someone who greets them, registers them in the common system registration database so that we know who they are and we can follow them. And then there's a skills assessment I'm going to talk about in a minute. That's the initial review with the individual to assess their skill levels, a brief discussion following the skill assessment, and then follow-up registration in iMatch Skills, as well as referral to the skills team for skill building for every person coming through the centers. The skill assessment is a key piece here because it measures basic math, reading, and locating information skills. We haven't had this before. This is a product that was purchased through an RFP process at the state level. There's been various products used across the state in different trials by different areas in the state, but no common assessment, so that if a person in Ontario or a person in Portland had the same test, that you would be able to compare the results and know where we are as a state in terms of the people that are accessing the systems. The skill assessment is self-administered. They take it themselves, but staff-supported. It's about a 15 to 30-minute process. We have some issues with that right now in terms of how much time that is taking. We'll talk about in a minute. But then the staff debrief with the person saying, you know, this is where your math scores look like, this is what you're reading, this is what your comprehension of finding information, and, you know, these are the kinds of products then that if you go to our product box, basically the menu of resources and services, these are the kind of things that you need to work on and can help you move up your skill levels. So there's different things that are in the product box that the staff person will direct the individuals to help them get to a level where they can be competitive for jobs in the market that they're in the location that they're in. And as an example, this is from the Salem Workforce Center. A job seeker that was coming into the center over the last 2 weeks wanted to apply for a job where she needed Excel spreadsheet skills. And she had worked in a job 5 years ago where she used those skills, but that was 5 years ago. And so staff directed her to an Excel skills through the self-guided, self-paced software that we have available that's in the product box now. And she spent several hours using the software. It helped her reorient herself to that and to the language. And then she felt confident, and she articulated that proficiency in the Excel spreadsheet when she applied for the job, and she actually got the job. So some of these people, these folks, just need a little bit of help up in terms of where they might be and what kind of jobs they're seeking. Others, I think we're going to learn over time, need more than that. But that's just one example that occurred over the last couple of weeks.
One of the things that Lori talked about, her final comment there, is we're learning more about who's actually accessing our WorkSource centers, and this initial assessment is helping us with both us and them recognize what skills they have and where they might be deficient. That's very important, because heretofore you might have a diploma, and it might be a high school diploma, it might be a GED, it might be a bachelor's, but what kind of skill do you have on the job in an applied way? And this assessment will really help us find the level of skill that an individual has, and then be able to hook them up with how to get the next set of skills they need to get that next job that they're after. So we are just underway here. We launched on October 6th, so we are less than 2.5 weeks into this new process. We are happy to report that the attitude among people who are coming to the offices, and many who might have come to WorkSource Center every week for the last 3 weeks or 3 months, when they are approached with someone who, as our consultant says, in our retail way, "Hello, can I help you?" instead of waiting passively for someone to come. So, "May I help you? Can I help you register? Can I help you with your initial assessment? Can I now talk with you about what we know from this initial assessment?" That job seekers are very eager. This self-assessment that Lori was talking about, some people sit down there and an hour later they're still there, because they are eager to know what kind of skill level they have, and we're eager for them to get up and leave because there are three people backed up behind them because it's their turn. So we are, as she said, we are soft launching, so we can learn through this process of how to best use the resources we have available. We have had over 5,000 people in the last 2.5 weeks assess their skills and be part of this common registration process, and it is working. We had a little hiccup, which would not be a surprise to anyone, but we are also learning every day. We had a phone call at the end of every day the first week to talk about what was going well, what was not going so well, to problem solve together about how we might step in with an immediate solution or an intermediate solution. What we are finding is that a good many of the people who are accessing the WorkSource centers have skill deficiencies. And we're not prepared to give you a full array of what that looks like, because we think that 2.5 weeks is, and 5,000 people is probably not significant. It may be significant, but it's not a valid test of where Oregonian skills are. But I can tell you that we have a large number of individuals who need some skill advancement and skill development. So what I mentioned earlier, that the programs that we are integrating at the federal level have some of the same kind of performance metrics, but some very different kind of metrics. And we have decided that what we want to measure are the number of participants who complete that initial skill review, and that's 100%. We want to know everyone who crosses the threshold, what their skill level is, and we want to make sure that 100% of people who come in have access to that product box, so that they are able to access that menu of resources and supports that will help them build their skill. We have really focused on skill development. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about the employer connection here, but it's very important. Once you know that skill, you know how to refer the individual to an employer, so the employer thinks that they've gotten a quality candidate, not just the first five live people who could fog a mirror, which is of no use to either the individual or the employer.
So in the end, the goal of this whole integration and journey over the last year is better quality services for the job seekers. Every customer leaves a better job candidate. They know their skills. They can develop their skills through product box services, and they can get the best job possible with their skills. Talking about skills, focusing that way with job seekers so that they know their transition to the next job is based on skill development is an important piece to communicate from the system, and then to help them access those kinds of skills. Some that are more complicated than others, but that's the intent in the end. And then businesses are better served because the job referrals based on more information about the job candidates, and they're better matched to the job requirements of those jobs at the end of the day. So this is the beginning of this journey, and we'll report back as we know more to you, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have at this particular time.
Thank you both very much. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. What's beyond the product box? And the reason I ask, and it may not be any connection, but maybe there should be. I was sitting in a meeting at the request of the director of Mid-Columbia Council of Governments last week, and he is working on putting together a financial package for a skills center. And if I understood him right, it's kind of designed after something in the process of being set up or expanded in Washington. Can you guys speak to that? What a skill center would be, and how would a skill center maybe be something beyond the product box where they could get some hands-on? Or
I think we both probably have some perspective. I don't know that I can articulate what the money, the federal, maybe it's federal money coming in for the skill center, possibly. We at the state level, we have a certain level of resources, and we're looking at what products in the product box can we fund across the system that's standardized. But then every community has the opportunity to put additional products in the product box. And that might come from private sector employers, it might come from government entities, it may come from grants and foundations. So we want to encourage the development of the product box locally with resources that they may have or ideas they may have to help those local residents. We're trying to provide sort of the base, you know, system and products that can help folks and be leveraged, but there's lots of room for what you're describing to happen, and we'd like to see that.
Please.
Kim, how could this fit into MyPath Careers and the website that we're working on?
Well, I think there is, Representative Huffman, I'm sorry, to your question. I think there there are direct links between the work that's happened in a multitude of places, in high schools, in community colleges, to map out what's the next step for an individual if they have a career goal. The product box is currently primarily based on online systems that are available 24/7, but there are links to other locations, as Lori said, to more site-specific, whether it's a college or a private institution, where an individual says, well, I really want to go do that. There is a way to connect that training or skill advancement either online or at a physical location, and that's really the customer's choice.
Other questions or comments? Cam, I know that...
I'll just make a quick comment. I just have to say this looks like a great program, and I was pleasantly surprised, I guess, not too long ago. I had a constituent call up complaining that the employment department would not let them apply for a job until they took this skill assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And so after talking to the constituent and talking to the employment department, found out that it really wasn't the case, and just finally convinced them it was to their advantage to go through this. And mm-hmm. I appreciate the employment department's helping people through the process that aren't used to having to go through a battery of tests that they think is unfair or something, but it was kind of, and I'm glad that that's probably a huge minority, and as a legislator we hear the problems, not really the successes. So
well, I think Chair Witt, Representative Holdy, I think that both Cam and I don't have rose-colored glasses. This is a soft launch. There's going to be lots of issues to work out. There was a lot of discussion about whether the goal should be 100% for everyone coming through the center to have a skills test or not, recognizing that many people may be fearful, and that's unusual if they've been coming, over time. It's a new something, and they're not sure whether they're going to like that or not like that. And I think staff have been pretty good at coaching people to, this is really going to help us help you in the end. It's not meant to beat them up or put them down or have a negative. It's really trying to figure out where they are and then figure out how to help them step up if that's their goal. If their goal is they find out what their skill levels are, they're happy with that, and then we job placement if that's where they want to be. But without that initial skill system, in the past we've kind of been driving a little bit blind in terms of helping people get where they want to go. So yes, we have some folks, and we think there will be some percentage that will not want to take the exam and or the assessment, and in the end if they don't and they want job placement services, that's what we're going to do, because we're universal access. But the first sales side of this is to say, let us help you, and this will be a benefit. We don't want them. Some of them are fascinated, as Cam mentioned. Let me assess all my skills at all levels, and they want to be there for a really long time. This is not meant to be a complete assessment of all skills you have. This is, do you have basic math? Do you have basic reading and finding information skills? Because those are the most common base skills that employers have to have if they're going to do training for you once you get there. If you're deficient in those, we might as well mitigate those right from the get-go. So, that's what we're trying to do with this. But, yes, we have some folks who, don't like the change, and it may take a while to adapt. But businesses, I think, are very focused on what skill level do people have and how does that work for my business or not.
Kim, I know that you mentioned that you had someone who was identifying best practices in other states, and I'm just wondering if your soft launch is far enough along that you've been able to adopt any other states' best practices as yet.
Chair Witt, I would say we actually sent a team of folks to Indiana several months ago, and they stayed long enough, several days, and toured several different sites. Indiana has a similar local-state relationship that Oregon does, and they brought back a lot of really good practices that they thought were worth trying out. They also learned some things they didn't want to do, and that's as useful as not. But actually, since we began a year ago, as Lori said, we started in October of last year, the state of Washington is now following suit and has retained the same consultant and is having the same conversation, all because I think the public workforce system recognizes that, as I said, the skill that an individual has is the coin of the realm. And if you can articulate it yourself or have a third-party assessment that says, yes, indeed, and we haven't talked about the career readiness certificate, which is in addition to this particular initial assessment, which I did want to tell you that it costs about $1.50 a person, about 50 cents for each assessed area. So we got quite a deal on that. But it's important for us to have that information, and the other states are also watching, because Indiana did not choose the same assessment tool, and the other states that are trying this out, they may have used a different assessment tool. So you know, there are lots of things to learn, but what I think we have been most pleased and gratified with is that individuals who come to the centers feel like they are perhaps getting a better service than they were before, and staff are feeling as though, even though it seems like a lot of work initially, that's work that's paying off. And so we have a really high positive attitude about the change.
Chairman, I might add, there when we began to work with Greg Newton, there are about 5 states across the country that really have been leading the charge on moving to this skill base. They may use different products, they may have a little different customer flow, but there's 5. Indiana was ahead of us, as was New York, and Oklahoma, and Texas and California have both begun to implement this, not statewide, but in some areas of their state. So there's 5 of us, including then adding Oregon, that are moving in this direction, with many others keenly interested as they look forward as to how to best leverage the public workforce system to the benefit of their residents in the competitive environment that we exist in, what that means. So we hope to continue to learn from those folks and have our own learning, of course, on top of that. So, we'll move as we need to make this a better system.
Fantastic. I want to thank both of you once again. You have both been exceedingly helpful to this committee in the past. We certainly appreciate your appearance today, and I can virtually guarantee you that we will be needing your assistance here in the next legislative session. So thank you both
thank
very
you
much.
So much.
Next, we're going to be hearing from Brad Avakian and Norm Eder. As they're coming up, I would like to briefly review some of the committee's findings from the 2007 and 2008 session, is I think a backdrop to this panel's presentation. As I mentioned briefly at the outset of today's committee hearing, we heard repeatedly in 2007 and 2008 that over the next decade, the employer community in our state is probably no different than states across the country. Are going to be facing an employee shortage, the likes of which I don't think any of us really have any concept of how serious or how severe that shortage is. And we heard it was every sector, it was every industry, it was every cluster. It was quite literally across the board. It was industrial, it was retail, it was agriculture, it was high tech, it was nursing, it was everywhere. And we heard that there were really two shortages. One in absolute numbers, and the second one being an adequately prepared workforce that possessed the kinds of skills that the employer community was in need of. We also found that there are things that are going on in our state that maybe are symptomatic and may be causal in terms of this situation. We heard that our state is not doing a terribly good job in terms of workforce education and training. Now, the chair wants to point out that there are underlying reasons for this, and we're not faulting either the education or training communities. They have faced a number of challenges, and I don't want to get into that protracted explanation. Nevertheless, while we have set the goal as a state for the preparation of a workforce that is second to none, we still have a very long ways to go in order to get there. And we also found, perhaps symptomatic or probably more likely causal, a lack of vocational and technical education and training in our school systems. And we had at length discussions about that. And Representative Huffman, your predecessor, Representative Dahlem, was personally engaged in trying to bring a number of programs into schools, both rural settings as well as urban settings. We found that all of this has a number of impacts on our state's economy. The global competitiveness of our economy at large, and also the individual competitiveness of individual employers, the employer community at large, as well as our workforce. And last but not least, of course, our state's economy. We found that there are 20% of our state's workforce that is working full-time, yet is are engaged in employment that ranks them at the very low end of the economic scale. Much of this, we found out, has to do with skill sets and folks' ability with the skills that they have to ability, or perhaps more correctly, inability to meet the demands of the employer community. This, in turn, has a whole series of ramifications. Folks' ability to function and exist in society at large, to promote economic and workforce development, and also ends up in many times in a vicious cycle where we find that folks' inability to achieve good-paying jobs leads to an inability to accrue additional skills. We are looking for some answers as a committee. We have not done our job if we don't, if we are not able to lead, if we are not able to provide an answer for the employees that need those additional skills and the employer community who, if they are to function and be able to sustain our state's economy, need a workforce that is adequately prepared. Part of the findings that we found were that our state, not unlike any other state, needs an integrated set of strategies for education as well as workforce and economic development. The integration requires planning, development, and delivery. And workforce and economic development cannot happen independent of one another. They are entirely and thoroughly dependent upon each other. Lastly, we found that this must be demand-driven. The industry needs to identify those skill sets that are necessary for a workforce to be successful, to meet the demands of the employer. This industry, of course, represents both labor and management. We also have developed a set of expectations. The state alone, our education system alone, cannot by itself identify those needs. We are entirely dependent upon industry assisting us with that identification as well as the delivery. This means support for curricula in our schools. It also means blending classroom instruction with practicums. I think that many of us have typically identified this as sometimes school to work, sometimes summer jobs programs, sometimes just an opportunity to go and visit an employer and explore job opportunities. Sometimes it's a full-blown internship. There are many possibilities there. And last but not least, an opportunity for our employer community, our workforce community, and our education communities to work together to improve not only their assessment and delivery, but also for them to be able to work together in a coordinated fashion, something that, quite frankly, we haven't really taken advantage of and been able to do in the past. Gentlemen, I know that both of you have some ideas of how we can move this kind of agenda forward, how we can translate the findings that we've had over two legislative sessions now into an active agenda. Welcome to both of you. Thank you very much for coming today. And I know that both of you have been very active in trying to promote an integrated approach here. You've spoken to several of us on this committee already. We look forward to your presentation today. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. I suppose I would first want to thank the committee for taking such a strong interest in the workforce development system in Oregon, and also would want to say that before I came to the table, I was listening through the TV to Commissioner Price and Director Warner's presentation, and just want to comment on the terrific job that they do with their piece of the workforce system in Oregon. Your comments, Mr. Chair, I think are really the staging for where I would go with what I want to present to you today. This notion that Oregon really stands at the cusp of doing some tremendous things with its economy and with its workforce, and that we have many of the tools in place right now to succeed, both in identifying the needs of our various industry sectors in Oregon and then building that bridge that connects it to the education and training programs that we build in order to fulfill those specific needs of employers. And what we have tried to put to paper are many of the ideas that have come from legislators, from our discussion with the governor's office, and from the private sector, and from the education departments in Oregon, that just help pull together all of the various efforts that are currently going on in the state in order to make that happen. So what we have done has created the concept that there are two things that Oregon can be doing now in order to enhance its workforce development system. The first is this, and I think you have in front of you a copy of two charts. One of them is the one that has the Oregon Workforce Investment Board in the darker square in the top left. is a very good depiction of what our current workforce system looks like in Oregon. You have what I would categorize as three separate entities that are governing bodies or decision-making bodies with respect to how to invest workforce dollars. And the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which in essence funnels $120 million of federal workforce money through a system that goes down to local workforce investment boards that then distribute the money to programs. You then have the Governor's Workforce Policy Cabinet, which is a grouping of agency heads which advise the governor on how to invest workforce money. And the one slight modification I would make to that graph is I would also give OECDD, the Economic Community Development Department, a third stool, in that it has its own separate pot of money that it can use at its discretion with the governor to invest in economic or workforce development. Now, all three of these, I think, do a tremendous job for the state of Oregon. What the piece is that we have identified that might be missing that would help us is that these three entities don't have a good mechanism within state government in order to communicate with each other, and don't have a mechanism that brings them all together with the same goals and strategic plan for workforce statewide. And that one missing piece of that cohesiveness between the three is something that I think limits the effectiveness of the state as a whole. The federal money, which goes through OEB, is in many ways handled very separately from the state money, which goes through the others. And the state money gets divided amongst up to eight different state agencies that have their hand in one type of workforce development program or another. So what we would recommend is a restructuring of that governance model, which is the second chart that you have, into one central workforce investment board of approximately 14 members, a majority still being from the private sector, but then standing members from superintendent of K through 12, the commissioner of community colleges, chancellor university system, commissioner of the Bureau of Labor, and the director of OECDD. And that new, more nimble and efficient board would have several responsibilities. The first would be to create 5-year and 20-year strategic plans for both federal and state money as a whole on workforce development. It would also make recommendations to the governor as the governor is putting together the governor's recommended budget on how to invest workforce development dollars. And the third would be an accountability piece that would track all of the money, state or federal, down to the program recipients to make sure that programs genuinely are graduating skilled workers that end up in Oregon jobs. The second piece to the concept would be to begin the restoration of career and technical education to our middle and high schools. Our university system, our community colleges, our apprenticeship programs all contribute greatly to a good skilled workforce. The piece we've lost over the last 15 years are what we used to call shop classes, now would be updated to a 21st century career and technical education model that used to serve the role as great feeder programs to our higher education system or to apprentice and career. We've largely eliminated those programs from our middle and high schools, and we think one of the reasons the average age of an apprentice right now is 28 as opposed to 19, what it used to be, is the elimination of those programs. And so we would be encouraging the legislature in the next session to look at picking a certain number of schools around the state to begin the restoration of some career and technical education. The last thing that I'll say is Manufacturing 21, which will present immediately after me, has some terrific concepts that we fully support that we think dovetail the governance structure that we're talking about very, very well. And with that, Mr. Chair, at the Chair's pleasure, I'd be happy to take some questions before leaving the table to Manufacturing 21.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for the Commissioner? Yes, Representative Bowlby.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, thank you very much for this proposal. As this committee knows, this is one of the things that we've discussed for a couple of years and sort of frustrated with, I guess, not that any individual agency was doing a bad job with their workforce development piece, but there was really no comprehensive look at, coordinating and having a really strategic view of workforce and making sure our investments were, aimed at an overall goal for the state of Oregon. So I commend this notion and this thought of basically doing a restructuring that accomplishes that ultimate goal of really I guess making sure that we're all on the same page and we're working together to move the workforce and skill advancement to the actual needs that industry needs. I think this is long overdue, this type of coordination. So just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, if I could, I was very pleased to hear you talk about the various elements and the good job they're doing, because we are in a very good position, better than most states, in that we do, in these separate three elements that I mentioned, do have professionals that are doing terrific work. And our task really, I think, is just to bring all of those together in a common effort, which is easily attainable. And so, Representative Holvey, thank you very much for that comment.
Brad, are you going to be able to stay through Norm's presentation, or do you need to leave?
If you would like me to stay, Mr. Chair, then I'll just stay at the back of the room till they're done.
Okay. I'd like that only, primarily because we're, of course, looking towards or anticipating a legislative concept here. And I would like you to be available to assist our committee in understanding how we're going to blend legislatively what you have just proposed to us along with what Norm is about to propose to us.
I'll be at the back of the room. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Before the Commissioner leaves, anything further? Okay. Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, my name is Norm Eder. I'm executive director of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition, a coalition of manufacturing companies. I'm here today to talk with you about an action agenda for workforce for the next session. Let me stipulate first that this is not a manufacturing agenda. This is a workforce agenda intended broadly to support the needs of our workforce in Oregon, improving it, connecting people who need and want jobs with companies who want people with skills to take jobs that they have. So you may remember that I was here in July, and so I seem to be a frequent visitor. And at that time, Chairman Wood asked me to lay out a general framework for how to think about creating an agenda. And I think I laid out 12 at the time, just concepts, ideas to keep in mind as you're developing your ideas for a workforce for the coming session. And I apologize for not remembering which one of you asked me the question. So, okay, now we've got the ideas down. So what is it we're going to do with them? And I remember my response my summer response was, well, give me a little time and we'll be back. And so today what I'd like to do is we'll quickly walk you through both short and long-term action agenda that begins with the proposition the two propositions. One is, first, understand the problem you're trying to solve. And on that account, the problem we ought to be looking at is and solving is the pipeline problem. Again, I was very pleased with the previous panel in the discussion of how the community college and the employment department are working together to facilitate movement into the training pipeline and to help Oregonians find their way to training and jobs that they deserve. The second is start at the start. And while that sounds simple, we have tended in the workforce discussion to embrace all ideas all at the same time, therefore really getting very little started. And so what we're proposing today, and I'll again walk you through a very short list of items that we think represent a beginning, but only a beginning, of things that can be done by you, by the state, to respond to what is a workforce crisis in this state. We have large numbers of citizens, of our fellow citizens, who simply don't have the skills to take the kinds of jobs that the companies I represent and other companies in this state have to offer. So on that note, I want to invite two colleagues up here who are going to help me do this, Agnes Balassa and Andrew. Where they're behind me. And so while they're making their way up, what we have are six ideas. First, we absolutely concur with Commissioner Vakian. We urge a reinvigoration, restoration, you can pick your adjective, of vocational education. It's absolutely critical that we do that. This is a very tough, challenging, and expensive item. We need to start somewhere in this next session down that path. Anything that can be done at the state level to streamline and make state policymaking on workforce more effective and more efficient is something that, again, that the coalition fully supports, and that this is a state, an important state issue, one that we need to devote full attention to, making sure we are as effective as possible. But we also recognize that local innovation and local delivery is really where the rubber meets the road with regards to workforce to our workforce system. What happens in your communities with your local workforce boards, with your community colleges, with the nonprofit agencies who participate in the system, with your businesses and labor organizations, this is where the action is. This is where people need training and find jobs. And so we have our beyond the first two items that Commissioner Avakian identified, we would like to see a much stronger and cohesive local planning system in the state that drives local planning, that brings all pieces of our training system together around regional plans that are not only developed but are committed to and are implemented. And at that point, let me turn it over to Andrew McGough.
Thank you, Norm. Commissioner Chair Witt, thanks for inviting me today. My name is Andrew McGough. I'm the Director of Work Systems, which is the Regional Workforce Investment Board for the City of Portland, Washington, and Multnomah Counties. As Norm mentioned, we think we have a pretty good structure in the state, especially as it relates to the local workforce investment boards that are out there. We are actually resourced to do planning and coordinating efforts focused on workforce development, and we would just urge the committee to take advantage of that structure. We have very committed local elected representatives, local business people, labor organizations, educators, all of the economic development. We have all of these folks at the table, and they're eager, ready, and willing to do the work. So what we would like to encourage is just look at that structure as a mechanism to build upon, and we're ready and willing to deliver on your behalf. If we talk about specifics, aside from sort of restructuring,
One of the things that we're proposing is a reinvigoration of summer jobs. It was a program that was federally funded years ago. It subsequently went away. We still do it somewhat with much limited resources across the state and in different ways. But it's not really just a summer job. It's really about providing a summer opportunity and a real work experience for a kid in a high-growth, high-demand occupation that also might offer some basic skills, some remediation, which ultimately allows them to avoid the backslide during the summer months that often occur and then often result in either diminished educational attainment or, in the worst-case scenario, school dropouts. Because as a lot of people were talking about, and Chair Witt, I really appreciate your focus on people because it's such an important thing that we sometimes lose sight on. There are a lot of people that need help. Only in my region, which is the metro area primarily, one in six kids between the ages of 16 and 19 are disconnected from either work or school. So they're doing neither. Youth participation in work experiences is at an all-time low. It's at 35%. It's the lowest rate since they started measuring this stuff after the Great Depression. And there's an economist out of Northeastern University who will tell you and will argue pretty vigorously, he's an interesting guy from New York, that the number one indicator of lifetime earnings is work experience during the high school years. So getting kids connected with employment opportunities over those summer months are critical to helping not only on the soft skills, on basic skills, but also in ensuring that our companies ultimately have kids that are connected to high growth, high wage opportunities in our communities across Oregon.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, it's great to be here today. Nice to see you again. I'm going to pick up where Andrew left off.
Agnes, would you please identify?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Agnes Belasso with the Enterprise for Employment and Education. We are also a local workforce investment board. And I'm going to pick up where Andrew left off, looking at some other components of the strategy that Manufacturing 21 has looked at. Although, as Norm had said, the strategy initially came out of the needs of manufacturers, the reality is that the same exact issues have been identified by industry after industry after industry. And some of what Norm's talking about are what have also been referred to as middle skill jobs, and that's what I'm going to focus on in this next piece, is the marketing and outreach piece of that, because what we're really talking about is the fact that even though you have a lot of youth coming out with high school diplomas, the reality is that both work and next steps in terms of education seem to require something more than what a high school diploma promises right now, yet something below what a four-year degree is what we're talking about. So there's the same entrance requirements for work and for the entrance requirements for work and for college are very similar, and there's still something more than what a high school diploma guarantees. I can speak for our local community college. 40% of Chemeketa students take remedial courses when they get started. We also know that there's a large number of employers across industries that have given anecdotal evidence about the needs for some additional skill development before they can hire even entry-level youth. And in fact, the Oregon Employment Department just completed a vacancy study that shows that in May, when the study was completed, although you had a drop in Oregon of about 6,000 jobs, you had lost 6,000 jobs in Oregon, you had over 50,000 jobs that were vacant, many of which had been vacant. In fact, I believe it was 20% had been vacant for 60 days or more. So you've got a critical mismatch there, and the jobs weren't just in any one category. They range across low skill, middle skill, high skill. So you've got an essential mismatch. So part of the issue here is you can create all the best programs you want. You can reinvigorate vocational and technical education. You can do all of that. But until families and until youth start to believe that those career opportunities are open to them and of interest to them, you're still not going to be able to feed that pipeline. So our recommendation number four is around creating online tools to engage young people and link them with resources, creating outreach so that parents and others understand what these opportunities are. You know, we talk about the middle skill jobs. Yes, they're in manufacturing. They're also your your respiratory technicians in hospitals. You're also actually your air traffic controllers count in that category, although it's a very well-paid category within there. There are also your police officers in our community. Correctional officers are a huge issue for us. Those are positions that are tough to fill, too. So there are all of those kinds of things, too, beyond just manufacturing. And what we need to do is help people understand the opportunities, because these are not the ones that are talked about typically in high school classrooms. The next piece is around creating short-term job training centers focused on key skills. And this piggybacks off of what Cam Porce-Brawley and Lori Warner had talked about, the work that's been done in WorkSource centers and in other places to try to keep focusing on those critical skill gaps and how to close them. So this is an opportunity to expand that even further and continue to build on existing infrastructures and close some of those skill gaps, especially because we know a large number of students can't go directly into education and training programs. There's a lot of youth who are either what Andrew's described in terms of your out-of-school youth, your dropouts, as well as those who graduate. Who simply just aren't ready yet. So this is an opportunity to fill that gap, create these short-term pieces, get them ready for education, get them ready for work, and make sure that we can fill that pipeline. I'm going to hand this back to Norm to focus on the last component of the plan.
All right, it's my turn to wind up. So the last component of the plan is you can put this in the category of the consequences of success. If we as a state are successful in driving more people into the skilled occupations pipeline, the very first problem we're going to have is not a programmatic problem. We're going to have an instruction problem. We do not have the instructors in this state to take up the jobs, take up the positions in the community colleges or elsewhere that will be demanded if we drive enrollments. So back to the beginning, our goal is to fill that pipeline. Filling the pipeline, the key metric is enrollments in training programs, and we don't have anybody to teach. And so one, I have two interconnected ideas. A shorter term idea is to create essentially a retired or semi-retired skill workers corps, people who have skills, who are currently working in industry or are retired, who would like to be a part-time instructor at a community college. The community colleges have a very difficult time identifying these people. It's a relatively small task to identify them, get them in a database, give them a very short period of training, 2 hours, 2 to 5 hours of here's how to manage a classroom, here's how to manage a blue book, and here's how to protest against your administration, which is an essential ingredient at any community college, and put them into classrooms as part-time instructors. This is a very powerful idea, and it has the additional benefit of bringing not only people with work experience into the classroom, and in many cases very contemporary work experience, but it binds their companies to the programs as well, because the companies would play a role in helping to identify these folks. The second element of this is to restore and to increase the output of our industrial arts educators. These are programs which, along with the programs of OCAD programs that Commissioner Vakian was referencing, have atrophied over the last 15 or 20 or 30 years. At the same time, the instructors for those programs have gone away. And so we have a shortage in the K-12 system of people capable and certified to teach those programs. And so we need to do something to address that problem too, to increase the supply of instructors. So to sort of sum all of this up, we've passed out. We have a colorful piece of paper here, a one pager that's got all six of these ideas on them that we think would make we believe would make an attractive, useful, and very strong beginning for addressing our workforce challenges and for filling the pipeline in the state. Restore voc education, streamline state policy making, and couple it to regional comprehensive planning. Reestablish summer youth programs. Create a marketing effort aimed at youth to bring them into the pipeline. Create short-term job training centers focusing on key skills to catch those people who fall between the cracks. And then finally, begin to create people who have the skills to be instructors in either community colleges, the K-12 system. It's not a huge package, but it's one we've thought about very carefully. It's the start that we referred to and that I referred to in July when I came before you. Identify the problem you want to solve and figure out where to start solving it, and then go to work on the, on it session after session after session. This is a generational issue, not a short-term problem. And I just want to underscore it with just a couple of additional pieces of data that I asked Andrew for the other day. And this is tied to the previous panel, Cam and Lori. As we begin to register more people into the WorkSource system, in the metro area, this is an estimate, there will be about 100,000 people who will enroll in the system. This is, what were there, 5,700?
5,400
last year. Of those, roughly 81, if they run according to, you know, a pattern, 81% will test below the 8th grade reading level, and 54,000 people of that 100,000 will require remediation before they're ready for employment. 91% of the metro areas living wage jobs require some form of post-secondary education. And just so it doesn't escape us, a 1% increase in the unemployment rate translates into over 11,000 people, 11,000 of our fellow Oregonians in the metro area alone. So this gives you some ideas of how much work we have to do, and what we would urge you to do is to begin at the beginning, take some small steps that get us down the, that begin down the path of making and creating a workforce system that works on behalf of Oregonians, whether they be employers, whether they be employees.
Thank you very, very much. Before I open this up for questions and comments, there are a couple of things that I think would be helpful. First of all, Norm, ask you to, again, to reiterate the figure that, that you had on remediation.
Yeah, I can do it because I gave it to him, Chair Witt.
All right, and Andrew, since you're going to do this, you mentioned earlier that, that this is the highest level of disengagement among students since the Depression. Did you say?
Yeah.
Would you repeat both of those?
Sure.
Those are key points.
Okay. I'm like the bad statistic guy. But we've done the work to look at them. One in six kids in our region, that equates to about 9,000 between the ages of 16 and 19, are neither connected to school nor work. They're truly disconnected from everything. So that's one in six kids.
And this, Andrew, just...
this is only Multnomah, Washington County.
Okay, all right, thank you.
City of Portland, Multnomah, Washington counties. On the remediation side, and again, Norm said this is a guess, and it is a guess, but it's a pretty good one. We think we will serve, in partnership with the Oregon Employment Department, about 100,000 people through the WorkSource system over the course of this year. Since October 6th, you saw that there was 5,000 people enrolled statewide. Well, 3,000 of them were enrolled in our region. Last year, in the programs that are managed by our board of directors, which are all the Federal Workforce Investment Act programs, we enrolled 5,400 in total. I mean, I think something that Cam and Lori have not taken enough credit for is they're lining up $100 million in investments for workforce development through this initiative. It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be their marketing consultant because I think they can use some help on occasion. It's a big deal. It's $30 million in our region. And we think it's really going to create the foundation that we need to look differently at this stuff. But anyway, so of those 3,000 people, we estimated originally that about 50% of them would need remediation. Well, we gave the skill test to everybody. 54% of those folks tested at the sixth grade level or below in reading. 54%. So if we get to 100,000, that's 54,000 people. And as Cam mentioned, last year our region alone got a 25% reduction in the monies that we get from the federal government to serve adults and dislocated workers in our region. It's a big deal. So, sorry to be the bad answer key guy.
Well, no, but Andrew, that's critically important because I don't think that we can appreciate the challenges that the employer community is facing if we don't come to grips with those kinds of statistics. And one of the things that we heard repeatedly in the last couple of sessions was that the readiness or lack thereof of people for the workforce, and one of the biggest challenges for the employer community. So if I show up, if you're my employer and I show up lacking these kinds of skills and functioning at a sixth grade level, then what do you as the employer do, or what do you have to do? That's the kind of economic challenge that our entire economy is facing. This is one of the biggest speed bumps that we are facing as a state in terms of our ability to move forward on workforce and as a result, economic development. You don't get the economic development without the workforce. So these are critically important figures, and as horrendous as they are, I appreciate your bringing that to the committee. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. my office in Forest Grove shares a building with an empty office. It used to be a WorkSource Oregon Center. What can we do about that? I understand, you know, we lost a lot of federal money. There are things that happen. But that office sitting there empty, that used to be a WorkSource Oregon Center, is really troubling. What can we do?
Representative Riley, I recall coming to see you several months ago when we didn't have the money to keep it open. What we need to do, and I think this speaks to really directly to what you guys are thinking about. The reason that office closed ultimately equated to about $50,000. But my real question was, see, and it was $50,000 of Workforce Investment Act money that frankly went away because we need to put money in Hillsboro and the centers in Hillsboro and the center in Tualatin and the center in, you know, and so we had to make a call about how do we support this infrastructure. But the issue was, here I am, the Workforce Investment Board. We have 80 different service-providing organizations in our two-county region that are engaged in some form of workforce development. We have direct authority over about 11% of that as a workforce investment board. We have no authority to encourage the level of partnership that's going to be required to keep those offices open. I can try and cut deals, and I can do the best I can to shake hands and say, you know, if we find some money down the line, but what are you going to do, Department of Human Service? What are you going to do, City of Forest Grove? What are you going to do, community colleges? What are you going to do, Oregon Employment Department? What are you going to do, you know, go down the list. The problem is that there's no coordinating body other than me that gets to go out there and shake hands, but I have no authority. All I can do is do the best I can to cut the deals. And we did cut a deal in your community, and I'm hopeful that we are going to reopen that center. Maybe not in that site, but we are definitely going to have access to services in Forest Grove. It's going to take us a little while because, again, I don't have any capacity to go out there and directly say, look, we got to come up with this $50,000. Let's get it together and make this happen. But I had to cut a deal with a small community-based organization who then had to cut a deal with the community college, who had to cut a deal, you know. So What it's going to take is some authority to coordinate. And I think this idea of creating these regional plans where we can sit together and get all of the players at the table and have a body that has some authority over creating that structure at the regional level is going to go a long way to making some of that stuff happen. My two cents. So.
Thank you very much. I'm going to do something a little unorthodox here, in that I want us to be moving towards a legislative concept. In that regard, Norm, I'm going to ask you to very explicitly list off for us, and I'm presuming it's this list of items that you want to consider us, or rather have us consider for legislation. As soon as you're done, I'm going to ask this panel to stand down. I'm going to call them back, but we're going to lose at least one and perhaps a couple of our committee members here. There are a couple of people who have come to support your legislative concepts, and I would like to give them the two-minute opportunity to tell us what they like or not about your proposal. So, Norm, if you would quickly, just for the committee, so that we know precisely what you're asking of us.
If you turn to the reverse side, so the pilot K-12 vocational education facilities first item, and a request of $20 million to begin that process, streamlining the OWIB and to develop the local plans, and the $5 million, the bulk of that would be devoted to assisting regions, the development of these regional plans. Andrew just made the case for those. It's very important. Reestablishment of summer programs, $5 million. Of summer youth programs, the development of an effort to directly market to youth regarding job and training opportunities in a way we don't do yet, $2.5 million. The short-term job transitions and training centers, $5 million, and train the trainers, $500,000 to develop the curriculum, begin the database, and implement it.
Thank you very, very much. If I could, Representative Huffman, before I leave.
Yeah, just quickly. Norm, is any of this integrated with what OWIB's doing right now?
The answer is yes, pieces of it are, and pieces of it I think need to be incorporated into that.
Okay.
But there's certainly no inconsistency here in any of the direction.
And I probably might not be able to stick for the whole discussion, but Cam's here, and she can probably speak to it. I was just looking at one of them, like the online tools that I know we're working on with OWIB, and I didn't know if this was a component that would be duplicated or if it's something that would be integrated. So just want to point that out.
One of the underlying themes in each of these proposals and in all the thought we've given is you begin with the system you've got. The system we've got has got good people working hard, and that, so we haven't started by creating new bureaucracies, new systems. We began at the beginning and then build on that.
Thank you very much. If you just stand down for a second here, I'm going to ask up, please, John Rakowitz from AGC, and Ralph Groner, could you come up and offer just very limited testimony, both of you?
Are you sure you want to ask Ralph?
Yes.
Limited,
Ralph. We've got the state police on notification. Limited, Ralph. Welcome to both of you. Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Rakowitz. I'm the Government Affairs Manager with the Oregon Chapter of Associated General Contractors, better known as AGC. I'll make this very brief. We have a member, a board of 62 members, very reflective of Oregon's commercial construction industry, and unanimously and ardently have voted to support both of these proposals. So we want to go on record for that. We thank the committee and the chair for the opportunity to do that. I would I would add one sense of urgency, just one more fact. In our industry today, the average worker, and it is a high-skill industry.
Yes.
Building trades, apprenticeship programs, there's a huge amount of resources going in besides the state resources, both from the industry side and from the trade side, organized labor side. Our average age of our worker is 48 years of age. We are anticipating that within a decade, we will be in a situation where we have 50% of our workforce will be disappearing.
Wow.
So within a decade. Just to underscore the point from an industry perspective, what does that do to the economy? So we would urge you, as we have done as an association, we have made a number of investments, and it's in your testimony that's been passed out, of our own investments to try to close some of these gaps. The larger systemic investments that you're talking about today are critical for our efforts to have the kind of results that we need. And we're continuing on with those today, despite the fact that our employers and their employees are faced with the same kind of current circumstances that everybody, every industry is, which is, in our case, it's delayed projects, it is layoffs, it is uncertainty about future work. Despite all that, our leadership is adamant that we want to support this kind of investment because it determines our ability to have a healthy economy for our industry and all industries not too far down the road when the economy does turn around. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you so very much, sir. Ralph, the Reader's Digest, two-minute version.
Yeah, Ralph Groner from AFSCME, and actually the AFSCME Environmental Caucus, which I began a year ago. Just a comment, I didn't realize you'd asked me up here, but mine's just a small piece of this, and that is that everything I hear about restructuring is wonderful, except you still need revenue. I serve on the Governor's Revenue Task Force, also served on revenue, and I can tell you, if we're going to do the things that education needs, that industry needs, that small business needs, etc., we have a broken revenue system in Oregon, and I won't go into that any further. I would say that on a short-term notice, there's something that occurred to me that I talked to the chair about, and it fits into this. And it seems to me that if we created the Oregon Public Facility Energy Efficiency Initiative in Oregon, when we set a goal right now, along with the other committees down the hall that are working on environment and all of those things, and then this committee's working on workforce. Once again, I have a thing about committees knowing what each other are doing and revenue, working on revenue. Not one of us really have, other than I have an ability to do it because I go listen to all of you, and I realize the interplay of everything, and separate legislative committees probably need to look at the word how they're structured. Now, let me give you an example. If we're going to have the efficiency thing that I've talked about, we could have an energy audit on every public building in this state, set a goal that within 10 years they will be energy efficient. That means that we train people, and we already are at the community college level and in the trades. We don't have the jobs for those folks who have been trained yet. This would provide jobs for them. We're going to have an energy trust, and that's our, I don't want to get into that. I don't have time about how we fund it. And it helps the environment, provides jobs, and will provide good quality jobs that provide income tax to come into this system to fund the very programs that all these folks are talking about.
Thank you, Ralph Groner. This is a record, sir. We appreciate it immensely. Glad to see that labor and management are of a united voice. With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting and open a work session. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to permit a motion to accept a measure for pre-session filing without the legislative concept draft before the committee.
Chair, this is a non-debatable motion. It's a procedural vote. I will explain further once we've completed the action on the rule suspension motion. It's just a procedural vote. It doesn't affect anything. So,
Vice Chair Rowley. Without objection. So ordered. The chair would accept a motion to pre-session file the legislative concept just explained to the committee for introduction into the 2009 regular session.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 832 and 833 be pre-session filed as a committee bill for introduction in 2009 regular session.
Vice Chair Riley moves LC 832 and 833 be pre-session filed as a committee bill for introduction into the 2009 regular session. Is there any objection?
Can I provide a little information in the process, Mr. Chair? Thank you. I spoke to our parliamentarian this morning and this afternoon about the process that we're doing here. So I'd just like to provide a quick run-through of it. What will happen is this is a kind of a preliminary approval of these drafts. Obviously, none of you have seen the language. We've seen the concept, but we have not seen the language. So what the process will be is, by taking this vote, we'll set in motion a process whereby once these drafts are received, and due to unforeseen circumstances, we were not able to receive the two LC drafts that we're talking about today due to unforeseen circumstances related to the drafter of them, plus a few other things. So what will happen is, when we do receive these drafts, we will provide copies of them to each of the seven committee members. They'll have a chance to look them over. We'll have the draft plus kind of a bulleted explanation of what's in the drafts, just in case there's technical language involved. And what each of the committee members will do is take a look at those, see that they meet their satisfaction, and then send notification to committee staff that they have officially, I believe the word Ramona used, signed off on that language, that they're okay with that language going forward as a committee bill, and it will require unanimous agreement among the seven committee members. So if all seven committee members, once they take a look at those drafts, say, okay, I'm okay with this going forward as a committee bill. And it's not, like other committee bill introductions, this is not I commit to voting for this once it comes forward during session. It's just a procedural motion to have it introduced as a bill during the 2009 session. So if you're okay with that, you would send word back to the committee staff once we receive word that all seven committee members are okay with that. Then, and only then, would it be introduced as a committee bill. So you're not committing to anything today other than agreeing to take a look at that legislative concept when you get it, and then if you're okay with that going forward as a committee bill, then that would be, once all seven have done that, then that would be the process. Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection to the motion? Once again, seeing none, hearing none, so ordered. Thank you, committee members, very, very much. Representative Huffman, we'll send the state police to clear the path. Thank you, sir. With that, I'm going to close the work session and reopen the information session. Did our previous panel disappear? There they are. Norm, would you folks come back up, or would you come back up, please? And Agnes and Andrew, if you come on up. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might, can I be excused, or
please?
I'd be happy to if you need me to.
Commissioner, you have a permanent hall pass.
No.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Brent. All right, with that, as I said, a little unorthodox, but thank you very much for your understanding. Questions or comments on the earlier presentation?
I know that the committee had a number of questions specific to Andrew in the Portland area.
Yes.
But just a couple of facts and figures to look at this statewide. One of the things that Andrew had commented on, Mr. Chairman, was the lack of youth engaged in work experiences, not only those that are totally disengaged, in which we have the Portland figures, but for those that are not engaged in work during high school, we have statistics that show that 16 to 19-year-old youth, as of 2005 is the most current stats we have, about 35% of those youth were engaged in any kind of employment activity. That was down from 50% only in 2000. And as Andrew said, that's one of the lowest numbers we've ever seen. In fact, it's the lowest number since the Second World War. They started collecting these figures sometime after the Great Depression, and it's been the lowest figure since the Second World War. That's for Oregon, not just national figures. That's specific to Oregon. Just to give perspective that it's not just a Portland Metro issue that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a regional issue there.
Thank you very much. Further questions or comments?
I was interested. I know that we've talked a good deal about kind of the whole classroom versus practicum experience. And in terms of our ability to deliver that practicum, I guess in an ideal world, we would set up vocational technical opportunities for any student in any school that wanted it. And quite frankly, the economic reality going into this next legislative session is we're going to have to pinch pennies wherever we possibly can. Once again, the reality is that we're probably going to have to settle for pilot projects in order to get this project up and off the ground. I would be interested in your feelings about how would we go about establishing a pilot program that would be fair across the state. How do we make sure that inner city youth has an opportunity to take advantage of a pilot program? How do we make sure that the student who is over in a rural southeast Oregon probably has to take a 2 or 3 hour bus ride a day to get to and from school, how do we make sure that it's fair that student access a pilot program? I don't have the answers. That's why I'm asking the questions.
You want to take Sam?
I'll begin, and then I'll let my colleagues make up for my inability to answer the full question. We have and I think I'm speaking for every employer in the state that hires skilled employees, a significant interest in seeing vocational education, vocational training, skills training reinstituted, reinvigorated. And I use those words purposefully because we may not have to do it the way we did it when I was in Cleveland High School. I attended Cleveland High School in Portland, and I took shop. Those spaces probably are used for something else, something just as useful, Shakespeare or something, which would be certainly a good use of that space. So there are many practical issues beyond the money, including a lack of instructors. And so what I think we need is creativity, and I think the answer to that goes to our local planning model, at least a part of that, the answer to that is, I think, allowing regions across the state through community of interest to identify their needs. And I am quite confident that vocational education, that this topic will rise very to the top of everybody's list. But allow them to determine how they will do it. The role of the state ought to be to set standards, to provide the incentives for those local communities to move on those aspirations, and then to if we're fortunate enough to find funding to assist districts and or regions in implementing a restored system, again, whatever form it may take. It may be in schools, it may be in the form of regional centers, there are many different forms it could take, but allow them to come to the state when they're ready, when they're ripe, when they're ready to institute these. And I think that there will be that Remember, we're just beginning here. So this is only a start. If the state sets those standards, less requirements than the aspiration, and then looks for local innovation in terms of how communities will, in fact, march down that road to restoration, I think you'll find that you'll find some are readier than others, sooner than others will be. Some will have great ideas. Some will have to learn from others. And the role of the state ought to be to inform them all. So it's a bit of a free market approach, but we firmly believe in local initiative, and that local initiative will lead the way, because that's where the training occurs. That's where the communities of interest lie. The state has a very strong stake in that. The state needs to be organizing itself in terms of policy and planning, but the delivery happens at the local level, and we ought to be working with that.
Vice Chair Riley, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that the thing about pilots is that they're not fair. They're not going to be fair to everyone, and there's no way you can make them fair to everyone. A pilot is designed to see if we can do something, to see if we can move forward, and then make it fair for everyone. But to try to make it fair for everyone from the outset is just an impossible dream, and not what a pilot's designed to do. So I think that right away, the answer to your question is no. It's not going to be in the first blush of this in the pilot program. It's not going to be fair. There are going to be some schools and some regions which benefit and others which don't. And that's the nature of pilots.
Thank you, Vice Chair Allen. I think you've actually voiced what I was running through mentally, and it's reason in part why I asked the question, because I think I know in advance, and I'm ready to acknowledge that it may not be entirely fair, but we have to have some basis upon which to pass judgment of whether we move forward, and if so, why, and on what basis. And so thank you for your very candid assessment of that. Agnes, did you?
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, if I could add to that, I think one of the critical factors in making any of this successful is the private-public partnership aspect, because the way that you're going to get leverage on any of these projects will be by that private-public investment, which is very localized, truly, but it's to try to move forward with any of these just on the public side doesn't make sense. So that in and of itself will start to define pockets where people are ready, willing, and able to try to make some things happen. Also, to add to Norm's point, we've seen tremendous progress in online resources in a number of areas, which mean that you can replicate what used to be a hands-on lab virtually on a PC for many, many industries now, to at least give the conceptual frameworks, even where you don't have a lab space, but then where you could partner with a private sector partner to create some kind of lab space. So I think there's a lot of ways you can do this if we stop thinking, as Norm said, we get out of our box and we stop thinking just about the way we traditionally structure programs and the way we traditionally think about the walls of a building and what goes on inside of those.
Thank you very much. That frankly, is a good segue to another issue that I have questions about. And if it seems like I'm consumed about the budget, I am consumed about the budget, and I'm only going to become more consumed by the budget, as will the rest of my colleagues, I think, as we get closer to and into session. But in terms of a partnership, I mentioned earlier that we are probably going to be forced into a pilot program simply because we cannot afford to do this statewide. It's just not there, and I think we have to admit that openly. We may be challenged also in terms of having adequate financial resources to run these the pilots. And the challenge is also an opportunity where hopefully partners would also engage. I mentioned earlier that our earlier findings were that
industry, business and labor had to identify their needs. If this is to be a demand-driven program, then it has to be industry that tells the education community what we need to be educating and training to. This may also very well be an instance where we need industry to assist us not only with the curricula development, but also providing resources. It may be materials. It may be teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think providing teachers so much the better, mm-hmm. Because we bring the experience of industry into the classroom. And if that necessitates us having to make some changes with the way our education credentialing sets requirements, then so be that. But I definitely envision the very realistic possibility that we're going to need some assistance from industry to help us not only make the grade but to pay the bill. Comments on that?
I couldn't agree more, Chair. Having been engaged in this stuff for a long time, something that kind of has occurred to me probably too late in the game that I shouldn't have been here, but I don't think employers have a problem paying for occupational specific training.
No.
They have a problem paying for basic skills, though. They think they already paid for it.
Thank you.
And so to the extent that we can help improve on that end, mm-hmm. not only just the basic academic skills, but those work readiness skills and those other things. I mean, we've heard that consistently over and over and over again from employers. But, if they want someone to learn to manage a machine or do something that's specific to them, they don't really have that much of an issue, I don't think, at least a good employer that I would want to provide a public subsidy to help support. Don't seem to have a problem doing that. And I think we've done some great things in this state related to career pathways and other kinds of work where we've actually worked with member companies in Manufacturing 21 as well as other people where we try and cut the deal. Look, we can take someone to this level of learning, and when you're ready to invest in them, we want you to consider that taking them up to this level. And trying to cut those deals right up front and being as explicit as you can with an employer about what you're going to provide and what they're going to do. And I frankly think that they really are much more eager to engage in that kind of model than sort of this amorphous, when we get there, we'll figure it out. And we have had no pushback at all and, frankly, a lot of eagerness on the part of employers to financially participate in that way. So
to add to Andrew's comments, because in our region we're looking primarily at small employers, the reality is you can't pick off one employer at a time because they don't have the time for that.
Mm-hmm.
And nor would we have the time to be able to sit down with every tiny company that we serve. Most of our companies are 50 or fewer employees. And so a lot of the work that we see being very successful around this is consortium building, getting companies together around the table, leveraging a set of trainings, whether it be around the basic skills or the higher skill levels, but that are defined by common needs, what cuts across the industry, and then trying to do it at a lower cost because you've convened enough people together to make that work, whereas any one of them couldn't invest in this on their own. So there's one piece of how it works. What we've also found is our training investments tend to pay off 2-to-1 in terms of employer match. So whenever we've put some public dollars on the table to try to entice a group to come around the table and have a conversation about not just your needs and not just your needs but your communal needs, we have found a 2-to-1 return on that every single time. So we are seeing the willingness of employers to put dollars on the table and to support training activities. I do agree with Andrew, it's a harder sell when they can't even find the basic skilled employees that they want, but we have had good luck getting them to better define what that means. We've gotten past the fog and mirror conversation.
Yes. So. Well, and Agnes, once again, you've provided me the perfect segue to ask the next question, and that is, as a rural representative, I'm keenly aware that many of the school districts in my legislative district simply by themselves do not have the capacity to be able to launch what would probably be a new program.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the money. They don't have a lot of the resources. They may, quite frankly, not even have the student population. However, if we were to form a consortia among a couple of the schools, kind of a regional voc ed center, it may be we may do wood shop at one school and auto mechanics or something at another school, but it would be a combined integrated program between a collective of schools. Is that something that you see as workable, and is that something, I'll tell you, it's going to be that much more of a challenge for everyone involved, including our employer partners. But I frankly would like to see a pilot that tried to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'll use Yanville County as my example. While it's really not quite as rural as many, many parts of Oregon, but we've got 8 school districts in Yanville County, some of them extremely small. We have one with just a couple hundred students. And so it's exactly the same issue that you've referred to, where there isn't scale in many of these schools to really take on a large project. What we've been doing along with Chemeketa Community College is to be at, and with the McMinnville Chamber of Commerce Economic Development program, has been to try to convene those schools at this point about once every couple of months, and they're in the process of doing exactly what you've described, trying to identify what could MAC, as the largest school, McMinnville High School, what could they provide that others could feed into, what would it make sense to distribute more across the other high schools, and where are the opportunities to bring business to the table on behalf of all of those schools in that county, as opposed to each one of them having to be picked off separately by each school district separately. So you're right, there's huge potential in trying to figure out how to do that. Now, granted, it's much more difficult when distances are even larger than what we see just in McMinnville, I mean in the McMinnville area and Yanville County, but we are seeing some promise with that, and with increased technology, there's greater potential to do that without necessarily always having to do the driving. So.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley.
And also, all of your school districts fall under the Northwest ESD. And I see that as a potential spot to coordinate from, that ESD.
Good suggestion. Very good. Very good suggestion.
Additional questions or comments for this panel?
Oh.
Yes, Mr. Riley.
Before we go on, I just wanted to let you know that one of my county commissioners has come into the room and has some testimony for this subject.
Wonderful. We would be happy to call her up here next. I want to thank each and every one of you very much for coming today. You do realize, of course, that you've asked for something, and the legislature is going to be asking back in a big way this time. Those asks are what are, I think, going to change workforce development in this state. And thanks for signing up.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You very much, Chairman.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Riley, would you like to invite up our next guest?
Yes, County Commissioner Desiree Strader is one of my county commissioners and one of the best, and I'd like to have her come up.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon and welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. I think probably my testimony is not that relevant now that I heard you guys pass this out unanimously before I arrived. But I would like to say this. I'm here in two capacities, not only as a Washington County Commissioner, but I'm also the chair of the Governing Board of Workforce Systems, Inc.'s Region 2, which represents Washington County, Multnomah County, and the City of Portland. And I worked very closely with Labor Commissioner Avakian, as well as the Economic Development Chair in Tim McCabe, in really formalizing this plan, and he does have our full support. But what I'm here in particular to talk about is the reformation of the State Board and why that is so critical. as we look ahead and as this legislative body, as well as the governor of Oregon, has staked their claim and legacy into renewable energy, workforce and training is probably one of the biggest obstacles we face. You know, this is a defining moment for our generation. It's the first time we probably will be able to create truly a statewide economy in renewable energy, with wave on the coast, with wind in eastern Oregon as well as the gorge, solar in Deschutes County as well as the valley, and geothermal in southern Oregon. But as we grow this economy, we are sitting there faced with a huge steep curve in training. And in addition to that, how are we going to fill the seats? You know, you have PV Power in Bend, for example, who's looking to grow and expand from a 59-employee operation to 350 in about 2 years. Where are they going to get that workforce and training? They're located in Deschutes County. It's going to be quite a challenge. And as you heard from the testimony from the panel before, recruiting costs to relocate people is astronomical, especially in these difficult financial times. So what we're looking for at the local level is really a streamline of the statewide board that really encompasses not only higher ed representation, but as well as industry partners, labor partners, because they are crucial in building this renewable energy workforce and green jobs, and as well as all of the other partners to really support what we are doing at the local level. And I really commend Andrew McGough, who you heard from earlier, because we led, and he led us over the last 2 years to really streamline our workforce system program in Region 2. And I think it's really an example of what can be done statewide in all these local boards, but also should be the example of what you guys do at the state board.
Thank you so very, very much. Questions or comments? Vice Chair Riley, our second witness, Ralph Brunner earlier, also making reference to the tremendous potential that our state has in green and renewable energy. Our committee had a field trip down to Oregon State University here. Gosh, I don't know, is that a month and a half?
A month and a half ago,
we saw firsthand the potential that we have, and in fact, the leadership role that one of our state's leading educational institutions is playing in this whole field, and not only in terms of research and development, but direct impact on our state's economy. It's overwhelming, the potential that our state has, and we are very well positioned. And as you correctly point out, we need to make absolutely sure that we have the workforce in order to be able to capitalize on this opportunity.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so very much. Certainly appreciate your taking your time to come today.
Oh, of course. Thank you. It was good seeing you, Representative Riley.
Are there other members of the public that would like to offer testimony this afternoon? Going once, twice, three times? Yes, Vice Chair Riley? Okay. Mr. Polby.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to offer an idea or concept. I don't know whether 2009 session would avail the opportunity of this committee to travel again, but after visiting Oregon State University and their economic development opportunities and renewable energies, I have spent a little bit of time with some of the economic development opportunities at the University of Oregon as well, with their material science industry and their public-private partnerships with many many of the leading technology industries in this nation and here in Oregon as well, with Invitrogen and Intel and many of the others. It's incredible what they are doing down there in financing a huge portion of the University of Oregon with these partnerships without public dollars. It's incredible. And then as well in Eugene, we have a summer program with the Northwest Youth Corps who offers opportunities for high school students to work, I guess, with when they get contracts. They try to contract with our federal government and with our state government in outside opportunities with Parks and Recreation, doing trail work, DEQ with doing some work with streams, and just all sorts of opportunities for kids to have hands-on experience with outdoor physical work. And these kids are not extremely at risk or the kids that are with correctional institutions. These programs are open to kids from all across the state, and actually serves communities all across the state with giving kids opportunities to work in outdoor opportunities throughout Oregon, Washington, and Montana, Idaho, California. It's an incredible program they have there with no state funds involved. So anyway, just a thought.
Well, and that certainly would be an opportunity, and maybe something that we could set up for when we get back into session and have our couple of week informational part of our program. If you could look into the possibility of the university hosting our committee, I think there would be several of us that would be very interested. Which also reminds me, I took advantage of an invitation from the Portland Art Institute to go and see what they had to offer there, a private institution. Phenomenal. And the potential impacts that, well, not potential, the very real impacts that they have on the local Portland economy, both in the visual as well as the performing arts, movie production, and all of those sorts of things, which I had no idea that they were involved in. And so I think it would be good not only for our committee members, but also for the public at large to know that these kinds of programs are available. And large contributors to our economy. Anything further for the good bit of good for the order here? With that, I'm not seeing anything further. I am going to close the work session and adjourn the meeting. Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate it, committee members, as well as the public. Thank you.